for a young child, what they need in order to keep, be able to keep these benefits of the cold, so to say, but in order to keep this practice and the joy of playing outside, they need, I think, parents that allow them to engage with the cold, to go outside without a coat on when it's raining, to, you know, step outside in the snow with their bare feet when there's snow, and to roll around in the mud, to get wet, to risk getting a little bit too cold.
You're listening to the Untaming Podcast.
Rewild the Child.
Here is your host, Emily.
Hey, welcome back to the third season of the Untaming Podcast. I hope yours and your family's lives have been smooth, happy, and healthy over the past few months. It's nearly 2 years now since we returned to New Zealand after living off-grid in Portugal. We thought it would take us a year at the most to find land, and now that we've reached 2 years, it's rather discouraging. You know, after 40 months living in a relative's garage, we've just spent the summer living in an actual house for the first time in maybe 7 years. And now we have very generously received an exceptional deal from a relative who has sold us his holiday house. It's in a small town much closer to where we hope to find land. We've been here a couple of weeks, and our plan is to stay for maybe a year, or however long it does take us to finally find our dream piece of off-grid land. And in the meantime, we'll do some small renovations on the house to, you know, help increase its value. My husband will continue to work online. I've already found a nature-oriented unschooling group here and have the kids in swimming lessons, so it's really nice to be settled somewhere for a little while at least. It seems like you enjoyed the 10 questions in 10 minutes episodes I released during the break. So rather than releasing episodes based on the Gregorian calendar, this season I've decided to continue releasing them based on the cycle of the moon, as I did with those short episodes. And while still trying to work out a podcast life balance, I'm thinking that this season I'm going to release full-length episodes at every new and full moon. And I will continue to release a 10 questions in 10 minutes episode in the first and last quarter moons. If you would like to participate in the 10 questions in 10 minutes, please feel free to email me or send a private message on Facebook or Instagram. I'm always looking for more participants. The first 10 in 10 episode for this season will come out on the 18th of June, and it is with a very special guest, my mum. The next full episode for the season will come out on the 25th of June. It is an interview our guest host Mary Frenzel did with Alma Gottlieb. Alma is a cultural anthropologist and author of many books, including A World of Babies, Imagined Childcare Guides for 8 Societies. So today's episode, which is being released right now on the new Long Night's Moon here in the Southern Hemisphere, is with Casper van der Meulen on cold exposure. So it's a topic I'm especially fascinated with, especially in our society where we have weakened our bodies so much that we think we need to be in temperature-controlled environments. I read a study from New Zealand last week that claimed that half of Kiwi kids are sleeping in bedrooms that are too cold. Now, just, you know, that headline alone caught my attention because I immediately thought of a few different things. One, that biologically we sleep at the coldest time of day. Another, that for most of our history we slept outside, so the variation in room temperature would have varied drastically in the different seasons. Another, that Matthew Walker, the world expert on sleep, has said that 16 degrees Celsius or 60 degrees Fahrenheit is the optimal sleeping temperature. And finally, on top of all of that, Kelby, who participated in the last 10 in 10 episode, mentioned how he has slept outside every night for I think it's close to 3 years now, and that's with temperatures reaching as low as minus 5 Fahrenheit or minus 20 Celsius. And despite suffering from severe respiratory illness every winter season prior to that, he hasn't experienced it at all since sleeping outside. So with all of this in my mind, I read the results of the study and realized that their baseline window of optimal sleeping temperature was between 19 and 25 degrees Celsius, or 66 to 77 degrees Fahrenheit, although it's still classed at or below 19 as too cold. So I realized that the study actually identified that most Kiwi children sleep in bedrooms that are too hot. But enough of my drivel, let's hear what Casper has to say. Casper van der Meulen was born in and grew up in the Netherlands. He lives there with his partner Anna and his five-year-old daughter. Casper is a best-selling author, breathwork specialist, storyteller and public speaker, founder and head teacher at Breathwork Masterclass, and co-founder of Move, Lift, Act, Breathe. He is adventurously curious in the art and science of breathwork, biohacking, influencing the nervous system, and anything related to human optimization. Last night he had 7 hours and 4 minutes of sleep, and for breakfast this morning he had a big superfood smoothie with frozen fruits, veggies, and superfood blends. Casper, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. That's a very, very cool intro.
So I first found you when I was learning about cold thermogenesis, and I got in touch with Scott Carney, and he suggested I contact you regarding an interview on the topic. And here we are. So thank you so much for agreeing to this interview. To start with, can you give us a brief rundown on understanding what is cold thermogenesis?
Well, cold thermogenesis technically is the process by which we trigger the body to produce heat in reaction to a cold stimulus. So it's actually, cold thermogenesis is a term that is used a lot to describe training with the cold, but the term itself actually means specifically utilizing the cold to trigger a heat response from the body, increasing metabolism. So it's a little bit of a limited term in that sense. I like to call it cold exposure because exposure is a more general term and it incorporates all the sides of cold training, including the emotional and mental benefits of it and immune system and things like this. Mm-hmm. But that's the general idea, is to use the extreme cold as a trigger to strengthen the body.
So looking up the health benefits on cold exposure, like the two biggest clickbaits I've found are either for performance enhancement or weight loss treatment, which I'd like you to just tell us about briefly before we get into the real heart of the topic.
Yeah, because those are the most boring parts of the practice, actually, the weight loss. And so imagine that our body is built as an anti-fragile system, as a resilient system. And we are fundamentally built to always respond to environmental stimuli. And our biology, so our well-being, the way our body takes shape, the way our nervous system, our immune system takes shape, our metabolism takes shape, is built to respond to these environmental stimuli. If there are no clear reasons for our body to create adaptation, we will not create adaptation. So it is a necessity to face ourselves with environmental stimuli to give our body a reason to become stronger, to become healthier, to become more resilient. That's the basic premise of training with the cold, but also training with weights, with endurance, with breath holds, with all the hormetic triggers. Now, one of the responses that our body has in relation to cold is to get better at increasing energy usage in the system, which translates to fat burning. So if you lower the body temperature and the body needs to engage a few different biological systems to make sure that we come back to homeostasis. So homeostasis is this state where we are metabolically at ease, so to say. So we have enough oxygen coming in, we are at the right temperature, all of the processes have the energy that they need, and everything just happens. That's homeostasis, and the body is always striving for this balance point of homeostasis. So if you lower the body temperature, the body will start to work to get back to this homeostatic balance. And one of the mechanisms that we use for that is to increase metabolism, which is fat burning, also sugar burning. But through cold practice, we actually develop the capacity to burn fat more effectively through developing an organ called brown adipose tissue, which is a fat tissue in itself, and then actually burns white fat and increases our ability to metabolize fat for heat and for energy in general. And then when it comes to performance, there's a few ways to look at it. Of course, an increased metabolic flexibility will increase your performance. Mainly people are using it to downregulate inflammation. So if you want physical performance, you train, and if you train, you basically create little micro tears in the muscles and you create a little bit of stress in the system, chemical stress. And these are the signals for the body to become stronger, to trigger supercompensation. And supercompensation is a process that I just kind of described where there's a trigger and then the body responds by becoming stronger. And one of the ways that the body does that, one part of that process is inflammation. So as soon as you create these little micro tears, this little chemical stress in the system, the body will respond to that by creating inflammation. And the idea is that if you downregulate this inflammation at the right time in your recovery process, then that will help your muscles go into the build back phase a little bit faster. So those are two very well studied and rarely well understood principles that people use cold exposure for. But like I said, I don't think they are the most interesting ones.
Yeah. So understandably, they're huge draw factors. But so what I'm more curious about is the effects on the immune system and understanding the evolutionary precedent behind temperature fluctuations. And then what you were saying before about homeostasis, particularly homeostasis of the parasympathetic nervous system. So can you talk about that for us?
Well, all of these systems mentioned, they don't work by themselves, right? So if you say, oh, I want to use cold exposure for recovery, well, then you're also using it for immune system function and you're also using it for nervous system function, because all of these systems, they collaborate, right? We are a biological system and we're actually a collection, a collaboration of biological systems that are always working together to provide life, basically, and homeostasis to keep us alive. Now, as soon as there is a temperature fluctuation, you need to adapt. And these adaptations are effective or ineffective based on how much you use them. So it's more about the core premise that we are an anti-fragile system and we need challenges, we need resistance, we need difficulty, and then we need the exact kind and dose of difficulty and challenge that we can actually overcome and grow from. So it is really about finding the zone within which you have a challenge for the system, a strong trigger, a survival trigger, a stimulus, that also is of the right amount, the right dosage, so that we can overcome it and have a moment of win. And that's how we become stronger. So this goes for the immune system, it goes for the nervous system, it goes for any part of the biological systems that we are. Because imagine if you would always sit in a temperature-controlled room. You can always be sedentary. There's always enough food. You always have a screen in front of you. You can always watch somebody else live an emotionally interesting life. There's simply no reason for your body to create strength and health and resilience and happiness and proper immune function and all of these things, because there is no environmental necessity. The body adapts to function. So if we don't ask a function, we start to lose the function, use it or lose it. So this is really... people who come to a point of poor health or lack of energy or, for some reason not feeling the way that they want to feel, at some point, most of them in the Western world, they will realize that they have not challenged their body well enough or not in the right way or not to the right extent. So it's an obvious example for somebody who's sitting on the sofa eating potato chips and just always being comfortable. But this also goes for athletes, for example, professional athletes or people who really want to have successful careers and corporations, and they're always overstepping their boundaries and pushing themselves. So whenever we live in an unnatural way, when we are no longer connected to the natural stimuli that give us strength and resilience, we can start to incorporate these stimuli into our life. And with cold training, this is, of course, a very simple way with a cold shower or with an ice bath or ideally with a cold swim in nature.
So, yeah, like you were saying about people getting too comfortable, like I know people who can barely tolerate a variation of about 5 degrees before complaining about it being too hot or too cold. And, you know, in this world of living in temperature-controlled homes and environments, it's pretty easy to fall into this comfortable habit. So as humans, is there what sort of evidence is there that we need these fluctuations in the temperature we're exposed to?
Well, it depends on what you call evidence. There's some scientific publications on this that make it very clear that training with the cold is an effective way, but it's more about the general understanding, the general theory that we adapt to function. If you stop using a function, you lose the function. And the thing is with temperature fluctuations is that there's a comfort to being warm. Right? And we want to be comfortable. This is an idea that we have. So we have this evolutionary drive. We have a very lazy brain. And we have this drive to keep us as sedentary and as warm as possible. This makes total sense if you live in a context of natural human life, which is the hunter-gatherer lifestyle that humans have lived in for most of our existence as humans. And especially if you look at how we got here, so our ancestors, our pre-human ancestors, they would have this necessity even more and for longer. So we're talking about millions of years of evolution living in a context where your next meal is uncertain, whether or not you're, so the weather is completely uncertain, your housing isn't ideal, and the only thing you really have to count on is your physical and mental resilience to be able to move with the changes in, for example, temperature and climate and food availability. So in that life, the most important and most healthy thing you can do is be as lazy as possible, to always think, how am I going to get a maximum amount of calories back for every calorie that I spent? How am I going to make sure that I always stay warm, right? So from that perspective, us paying money to expend calories worthlessly without any investment in a gym by lifting objects and moving objects around that don't need to be moved around. I mean, the weights are fine where they are. That is complete luxury. It's a total flip off of how we used to live, because if you live in this primitive setting, in this context where basically life is scary and dangerous and it's constantly coming at you, it's weather and it's predators and it's disease and like all this stuff, then it would be ridiculous to just go move a bunch of weights around for expending calories. That would be ridiculous. So we are built to seek comfort, which is warmth, is comfort, the right temperature. We are built to seek being sedentary and to seek high calorie inputs. So if you place that hunter-gatherer physiology in a modern world like we're living in today, it's very understandable why people lack resilience and why so many people are sick and developing all these lifestyle diseases or have a low resilience to life in general.
So I guess, like what you're saying, our ancestors didn't have to unnecessarily challenge themselves with the cold. That would have been like a waste of calories for them. They didn't have to force these temperature fluctuations, right? It was just what occurred naturally in the natural environment. Yeah,
they were always there. But at the same time, there is a lot of primitively living cultures. Well, we call them primitive from our Western perspective, but they were highly advanced, of course, in many ways, but they weren't technologically primitive. Like, for example, the North Scandinavian Sami, who have a very common practice in the middle of winter when it's minus 40, that the first thing they do is they jump into the snow. They take a snow bath, then they dry themselves off, and then they get into their, you know, warm reindeer skin clothing. Because they already understood that if I face myself with the cold before getting comfortable in my gear, then my body has the natural tendency to increase metabolism. They probably don't have those words for it. But, you know, my body will heat itself up. My body will feel strong and energetic. And if I then go into my clothing, my body will be more active. So it's about triggering this willingness to expend energy. And there's multiple multiple people that that have been studied that live in cold environments, primitively, so to say, that use these practices.
Huh. Interesting. Can you, before you mentioned brown adipose tissue, can you tell us more about that?
Well, brown adipose tissue is a bit of an elusive thing scientifically. There's, well, now there's more and more studies on this. So basically, it is a tissue. It is a fatty tissue. That's why it's called brown adipose. So adipose points to fat, basically, in normal words. And this is brown fat, and it's colored brown because of the really high density of mitochondria. And mitochondria are the energy factories of the cell, and they happen to color brown. The fat that we carry around our waist that we would like to have less of when it's bikini season is white fat. And we all know that if we want to burn fat, we need to move. And if we move, we also produce some heat. So in order to burn fat, we need to do a bunch of movement. And as a byproduct, we have heat. Now, what brown fat can do as a tissue is it can increase metabolism and body temperature with barely any movement. So it can take white fat, the calories in white fat, and convert them into heat energy pretty much right away. It just needs a little bit of an of movement, like a shiver or a slight movement to start this process. And this is actually an organ that was thought to only exist in babies, because babies need to be able to regulate their body temperature, big temperature fluctuations, but they don't have the musculature. They can't walk, basically get up and move around and do a few jumping jacks to warm themselves up, because babies are just laying down most of the time. They're sedentary. So they can actually change their body temperature with the use of this brown fat. And it was always thought that we lose this brown fat over the years when we age. And it actually turns out that we only lose it if we don't use it. So people who work outdoors, who have a lot of exposure to cold, they develop more of this tissue. Now, the existence of this tissue in the human body has been linked to, for example, a better insulin resistance. And this is one of the reasons why it's studied so much, because insulin is a big issue, since so many people are struggling with insulin resistance, and a lot of people with, you know, troubling versions of that in the form of diabetes type 2, for example. And other, a lot of metabolic diseases or issues are, of course, linked to insulin, to the ability to use insulin correctly. So brown adipose tissue is kind of seen as a silver bullet against a lot of these metabolic deficiencies and problems. And all you really need to do is have regular exposure to the cold, and your body will start to develop more of this tissue, or use the thing, the tissue that you still have better. And that's one thing that I think science is fairly inconclusive about, whether it's something you actually gain over practice or where you always keep the tissue, except it just starts to reactivate with usage. That's not entirely clear yet.
I see. So with what you were saying about how it's higher in babies, and in our sedentary sort of culture, we tend to lose it as we get older since we're not using it. Do you know how we can keep it? I mean, as babies, how do we help them maintain it as they grow up?
Play outside.
Yeah.
Yeah. Play outside. That's that's the cure for everything. Play outside.
As simple as that.
Like in all, and it's funny too, because I do these ice bath workshops and retreats, and then parents, they call me and they go like, yeah, could my kid join, because I think it's really good for them. No, all this, yeah, he's nine and he's just like not feeling really well, and you know, he's trouble concentrating, blah blah blah. And then I ask them, do they want to sit in an ice bath? And then usually the parents go, well, no, not really, but I think it would be good for them. And then I ask them, well, would they maybe want to play outside when it's raining and roll in a muddy puddle and climb a tree and fall out of a tree and stuff like that? And then they go like, well, yeah, but that sounds dangerous. That sounds like a bad idea. Well, and that's kind of the problem. We should be spending way more time walking, playing outside when it's not nice weather outside. We should be running in the rain. We should be getting dirt under our nails and climbing trees and getting, you know, little scratches on our skin. This is really what we need to keep our resilience, and we need to keep doing this. But we get kind of tricked into sitting in chairs most of our young lives, and then we keep doing it in our adult lives, and we lose a lot of health and resilience and a lot of joy in life because of it, because we isolate ourselves from outside. So practically, though, for example, with babies in Norway and a lot of countries actually, and in the Netherlands also a little bit, it's quite common to have your stroller with a sleeping baby outside. Just leave it outside.
Yeah.
So a lot of this, and well, it's not very common in the Netherlands, because I got a lot of we used to get some people very worried. One of my businesses is a gym that I own, and we'd be training inside, and then our stroller with the baby would be outside, and there were very worried people like knocking on the windows like, there's a baby left outside by itself and it's raining. This is irresponsible. But the whole idea is that it's cold outside, but the baby is very warm under the blanket. So if you are sleeping in a cold environment, in a very fresh environment, but your body is warm and safe, then your system will still kind of scan, so to say it simply, still notice that it's in a cold temperature, which means that it will create adaptations for this cold temperature. So you don't have to feel cold in order to use the cold to improve your health, because just being in a very cold environment and feeling, for example, on the skin of your face that it's a cold environment, but being warm under your blanket, that is already a way to use the cold as a trigger to improve, for example, the usage of brown fat. So even for babies, that's something that you can do. With young children, small children, they tend to not really be in touch with their boundaries as much as they should be. They're very much in touch with their body and with what it tells it, but they can't think ahead in the sense that they think, okay, if I'm going to stay outside for 5 more minutes, then 5 more minutes from now, I will probably be too cold, right? So they can respond really well to their body needs, but only in the moment. So for a young child, what they need in order to be able to keep these benefits of the cold, so to say, but in order to keep this practice and the joy of playing outside, they need, I think, parents that allow them to engage with the cold, to go outside without a coat on when it's raining, to, you know, step outside in the snow with their bare feet when there's snow, and to roll around in the mud, to get wet, to risk getting a little bit too cold, but for a parent to be there and to help them determine what is their boundary and what is good for them. And also to at some point to say, okay, we've been doing this for a while. Now I think it's a good idea to go inside. And it's completely fine, but to at least have them do that. And of course, there's different situations where you do that and where you don't. Like if I have to do a bike ride, and I know it's a 20-minute bike ride to bring my daughter to school, and it's raining outside, and she says, I don't want to wear my coat, I don't want to wear my jacket, then I know that that's a very bad idea, and I could be a very free parent to be like, okay, just feel your own boundaries. And then 20 minutes later, I have a hypothermic kid that is going to have to sleep and eat for the rest of the day to recover. So, but if we're playing and we're playing inside and it's raining outside and she wants to play in the garden and she doesn't want to wear her jacket, then I tell her like, sure, just go outside and just let me know if you get too cold and we'll grab your jacket. And that's, you know, it's completely fine. She's always done that.
It's great. I'm like nodding along here going, yes, I like this. This is great. Okay. So following on from what you were saying earlier about the immune system, I've heard of improvements with regards to autoimmune diseases through cold exposure. Can you share any insight into this?
So autoimmunity is a process by which the body's immune system is attacking the body itself. So it's attacking tissues or organs that belong to the body, which is not what the immune system is supposed to do. So if you want to describe the immune system very simply, it's actually not one system. It's actually a collaboration of many different systems that create immunity. But immunity is the process by which the body determines what belongs inside, what belongs outside, and when something is inside that doesn't belong inside, how do we get rid of it? And there's different processes for that. One of the processes is called inflammation. And this is also called the second line of defense, so to say. So it's a more general immune response where if as soon as something crosses the barrier into your body, and the barrier is your skin, your mucous membranes, the acidity of different parts of your body, for example, the stomach or the vagina, the hairs you have in your ears, the hairs you have in your nose. So everything that's meant to keep stuff out is called the first line of defense. And as soon as this first line of defense is breached, so the pathogen or a toxin or whatever comes into the body, then it is up to the second line of defense to deal with what has come in. The second line of defense basically means that there is an increase in the general security of your system, right? So there's a higher patrol, and the patrol is done by white blood cells. And sometimes your temperature goes up a little bit. If it's local, for example, in a joint, then you might see it turn red, it becomes warmer. So you can look at the general inflammation, the second line of defense, as an increasing of the security level within the system. So first line of defense is basically the walls of the building. And as soon as the walls are breached or something comes through the door that isn't supposed to be there, then there's this general inflammation where all the security people are gonna march around and check where this pathogen is and see if we can kick it out. And then just to complete the story, you have a third line of defense, which is the specific immune system, which is kind of like the special service. If you once have, for example, one type of flu, then your body or one strain of the flu, then your body will eventually figure out how to deal with it. It might take, you know, a week of fever and inflammation for the specific immune system, the special service guys, to figure out how to kick this specific flu strain out. But once it's done, this special service, this third line of defense, a specific immune system, knows exactly how to deal with that specific pathogen, and it could never harm you again. So those are kind of the three levels. Now, autoimmune disease is usually an overreaction and an unjust reaction of the second line of defense of inflammation that is attacking the own body in a lot of cases. That is why that happens. Now, this can be triggered by many different things initially, like, for example, living in a toxic environment, breathing in things that you shouldn't be breathing in, like all the stuff we're breathing in nowadays, like microplastics and fine dust and actual pathogens, things that we eat. There's high toxicity in the food by, for example, weed killers like glyphosate. But there's also, very heavily processed foods with all kinds of things in there that shouldn't be in there, plastic in our food. So there's many, many things that are constantly creating oxidative stress in our body. And all of this stress needs to be fought off with little immune responses, little inflammatory responses. So every time you eat something that is damaging and you create a little micro tears in the gut lining, then our immune system needs to get to work and clean this stuff up. So we're creating these little spikes in inflammatory activity in our system. Now, in some cases, that can turn into the immune system going on this higher level of defense for a longer amount of time. So that basically becomes an autoimmune disease when the autonomic immune system keeps the inflammation at a really high level for no reason at all, or for the reason of constant inflammatory triggers coming in. Now, the cold, for example, taking an ice bath, has been proven to downregulate that type of inflammation very effectively. And you can think about, as soon as you step into an ice bath, you have a very, very high survival situation. At least that's how the body perceives it. So If you think about these inflammatory responses being long-term, because short-term inflammation is great, like I said before, like short-term inflammation is what you need to trigger muscle growth, for example. All right? It's a very powerful system, and you need it. Chronic inflammation is where the problem is. That's where it gets out of whack. Now, if you are in a state of chronic inflammation or chronic stress, and you have a very, very immediate, a highly immediate survival trigger that is higher on the survival scale than the chronic stress or inflammation, then that is a trigger for the system to downregulate that inflammation. To switch into acute stress means to switch out of chronic stress briefly. So, for example, by triggering adrenaline with an ice bath, the cortisol that is keeping your chronic inflammation going will be switched off for just a little bit. So if you do a daily training with extreme cold, then that is a daily little, in a way you could call a little reset for the chronic stress and inflammation, and an opportunity to step out of that chronic stress and inflammation.
What sort of time, like time frame sort of thing are we looking at? How long would you be in a cold shower or an ice bath for to have this sort of effect?
About 2 minutes. 2 minutes is enough.
Oh. Yeah, well, that's not too bad. Okay. Now, I'm curious about, what about our responses like shivering? Because I grew up believing that shivering was our body's way of keeping us warm, and it was dangerous to stop shivering if you were cold. But cold thermogenesis is a non-shivering mechanism, right?
Not necessarily. No, shivering is fine. No, shivering is great. Your body knows.
Yeah.
Trust the body. It knows. Suppressing shivering can actually lead to problems. And like I said before, the brown adipose tissue, so being able to produce heat without movement, needs a little bit of movement as a kickstart. So there's a lot of people who want to train with a cold, and they're suppressing their shivering because they think it makes them, well, look really tough. And it makes them, it's like, no, I need to suppress my shivering, and then I'll force my body to become warm some other way. But fighting the body is never really the way. The shivers, they should be that you can see them as an initial release of energy, of activating in reaction to the cold. And there are some publications that show that brown adipose tissue only activates after some muscle movement, which is of course, shivering.
Okay. And then what about bodily processes? Like, how is our circulation affected by cold exposure?
Well, as soon as you get, circulation is one of the systems that regulate thermogenesis. As soon as you go into a hot place, you know that your circulation opens up in the periphery. So in your, for example, if you step into a sauna or it's a very hot day, you get a red skin and you get warm hands and you get swollen hands. So there's more circulation brought to the extremities to circulate warm air at the surface so that air can pass by it and carry away the heat. That's how we lose our temperature. In the cold, you have an opposite system, basically, where as soon as you hit a cold environment, you will have vasoconstriction. So all of these capillaries in the extremities will constrict a little bit, causing the warm blood to circulate less to the extremities, to lose less of your body heat to the environment. So when we train with the cold, especially if we go from a warm place to a cold place and from a cold place to a warm place, we are training the flexibility of these capillaries of our circulatory system to get better at moving between vasodilation, which is opening, and vasoconstriction, which is constricting the blood flow. And that is like a strength training workout for your circulatory system.
Aha. Now, having gone over all of this regarding cold exposure, are there similar significant effects to the opposite extreme, like heat exposure?
Yes. So cold exposure. So basically, you have a system of thermoregulation, and thermoregulation works in both directions. And if you train the one side, you also train the other side. It's to say it simply, that's kind of how it works. So, for example, I used to get heat migraines, and after a winter of training with the cold, suddenly in the next summer, my heat migraines were gone.
Oh, wow. Huh. It's very interesting. And so then, I was going to say, do we need to have both cold exposure and heat exposure to get different benefits? But I guess we don't really need to. Just one of them would suffice.
Well, the practice is definitely more complete with both. Like it's really ideal to have both. Yeah. And also having a really hot shower and then a really cold shower is great. But the ultimate practice is going from a sauna into ice cold water.
Yeah, nice. Now, before we wrap up this discussion on cold exposure, you had some great suggestions before regarding children. Are there any more cold exposure practices you do with your daughter that you could share with us?
I just show her the living example. That's all. I invite her to come and play with this stuff. I mean, she has grown up in settings where I would be teaching retreats where we would climb mountains and in our shorts and like jump in frozen waterfalls and like all of this type of thing that she has just seen as people do. And she'd be walking around in a little skiing outfit. And like once we were with a group of 30 people in shorts going up a very icy cold mountain, and I just carried her on my neck. And she like, so I think it's more important for her to realize that this is something normal. This is something that people can do. Especially in the summer at our gym, if we have an ice bath session and it turns into a little ice party, and then, you know, the kids are playing with the ice cubes and they're seeing what it feels like, oh, my hand got so cold that I can't move my fingers anymore. That's so interesting, you know? So usually when people, their hand gets so cold that their fingers can't move anymore, they're like, oh, no, this is dangerous. What's going wrong? Is this going to be okay? And these kids are like, oh, this is so interesting. This is so cool. And I think that playfulness is really what it is about, because very honestly, if I train people, especially in a retreat setting, my end goal is to get them back to that playfulness. So I use methods and techniques and protocols and systems that are all meant to get rid of methods and techniques and protocols and systems and just to be able to play again. So I think being playful, involving children in this without forcing them to do any of it, but just to be around it, I think that's really the way to go.
I like what you said there before as well about like showing by example. My husband and I often go hiking and camping, and we always try to stay next to a lake. And so our kids have both seen that, you know, they'll see us in the mornings. We'll force ourselves to go into these ice cold lakes with snow on the mountains around us. And so now they're 2 and 5, and they'll start to follow us in there as well. They just see it as normal, like you said.
Yeah.
Before we finish on cold exposure, is there anything blatant that I've missed here that you would like to talk about?
No, not at all.
No? Cool. So last year I had the good fortune to interview Dr. Ray McClanahan. I'm not sure if you're familiar with him. He's a barefoot podiatrist and the creator of Creek Toes. But I bring him up because I read that you have run ultra marathons barefooted. So can you please share with us what an ultra marathon is and why you have run them barefoot?
Well, actually, I ran a normal marathon barefoot, and my ultra I didn't choose. But specifics, but an ultra marathon is anything, usually is called anything more than a marathon, right? So that's called an ultra marathon. And so for example, 50K, 100K, 100 mile distances like this. And I've done a few, like the most I've done is 56K in Switzerland, the Eiger ultra marathon, which had 3000 meters of total elevation. And this was a very, very rocky terrain. I wouldn't have been able to do that barefoot. But I ran a marathon barefoot on the beach, actually, and I thought that that would be a great idea because the sand would be nice and soft, but that was not the best idea in that sense, but it went really well. It was a great time. I basically just got up really early in the morning, and we have a very long, basically our coast in the Netherlands is one, like a 100-mile stretch of beach on the west. In the west of the country. And so I just went to the beach and then I ran 21.1 kilometers north, and then I turned around and ran the other 21.1 kilometers south, and that was my marathon. It was a very interesting process. Yeah.
So you did the entire 42 kilometers on the sand on the beach?
Yes. Yeah. Which had a lot of big downsides, actually, because, you know, it's not straight. So the first half, my hip was tilted in one direction, and the second half my hip was tilted in the other direction, which is not ideal. I realized that sand turns into sandpaper, which is can be very painful on the feet, but I just found ways to move from wet bits of sand to dry bits of sand and deal with it, and it was a very interesting process.
So does your daughter spend much time barefoot?
She loves being barefoot, and especially, well, indoors, we're always barefoot, and she loves to go outside in the lawn and walk barefoot. And in the summer when we go out camping, she, it's funny because now she's at an age where she's really thinking, discovering how does the world work. And as soon as she hits discomfort or pain, then she is likely to kind of move away from it. So she loves being barefoot, and she steps on one thing sharp, and then she's like, no, I'm gonna always wear my shoes from now on. And then next day she forgets, luckily, and she's barefoot.
Yeah. Do you have any sort of like special footwear that she wears when she does wear shoes?
Not really. I usually I like to have her to have her wear shoes with hard soles, at least. So if they're not like barefoot minimal style shoes, then I like them to be hard. And I don't like her to wear, I prefer her not to wear any soft soles, any sneaker type soles. Mm-hmm. So we're not kind of like, we don't have 100% barefoot style shoes. I like to think also about resilience in a way where it's about diversity. And diversity, and I really think also in parenting, building a resilient human that is ready for this world means to build in as much diversity as possible, to have different experiences, eat different foods, and also have different types of footwear, and just to be able to switch from one thing to the other. And my daughter gets an amazing training in this as well, because her mother and I are no longer together. So she lives in two households with different life philosophies and different styles of parenting and different most of everything. And she flows between that very well. So that also means that I don't get to decide everything about how she is and what kinds of shoes she wears and what she experiences and all this stuff. And this is a great process for me of letting go, because a lot of parents, they feel like, oh, I have this child now and I need to protect this child from all the stuff that I would have loved to be have been protected from. And this is how I'm going to do all of this. And a lot of parents live in a assumption that it is possible to control all of these variables. And it costs a lot of energy and it costs a lot of personal well-being to try and control all of these variables. So, yeah, to me, it's a blessing to be invited, so to say, by life in general, to also practice letting go and to see the flexibility that this child has.
Yeah, thanks for sharing that insight. Yeah. So last year I did an interview on natural dental health, and I hope to do another in the future. One of the reasons is to do with the effect on the developing palate and the alignment of teeth in the jaws regarding tongue position in the mouth and breathing through the nose compared to mouth breathing.
Yeah.
And the parallels here is with your own work as a breathwork specialist. And I wondered if you could share a little insight with us into breathing.
Well, most of the time, let's say almost always, except when you're running or working out, nasal breathing is superior to mouth breathing. So the nose is a filter. It's an air conditioner. It's a humidifier. It makes sure that every breath of air is enriched with an amazing chemical called nitric oxide, which is very important for metabolic processes. So it's the most important part of that first line of defense of your immune system, because it's a huge filter, and your respiratory system is the only system that is always exchanging particles with the outside world. So imagine that like everything in your body is closed off from the outside world, and then you have your senses open, of course, but there's always stuff coming in from the outside into your lungs. If you breathe in through the nose, then you have the filter hairs, the cilia, you have the nasal sinuses, you have the mucus, and all of these systems to keep stuff out, basically, to keep stuff that doesn't belong in your body out of your body. If you breathe through your mouth, all of that stuff comes into your lungs unfiltered, and it actually creates a higher inflammatory load in your immune system, because then the immune system has to deal with whatever comes in. So nasal breathing is superior. Now, if you chronically mouth breathe, what happens is that the jaw and the formation of the skull actually changes. It, first of all, it makes your bones more brittle, so there's a less capacity to have a nice, structured, strong face. It creates dental problems because you have all of this unfiltered air passing by your teeth that shouldn't be there, right? So if you, even just through the night, if you mouth breathe, if your child mouth breathes during sleep and it sleeps for 12 hours in a night, young children, that's 12 hours of air, unfiltered air, passing by the teeth. It's very bad for oral health, for dental health. And over time, it leads to structural problems with the jaw. And one issue is, if you have an improper tongue position, which also comes with mouth breathing, is that the tongue isn't resting against the palate. And also, a lot of people develop poor swallowing habits, which means that there's no muscle action of the tongue on the upper palate, which actually causes the upper arch, jaw arch, to become more narrow, because that is built to develop a nice, broad, and strong structure in response to the tongue pressure against it, which will cause the part, so the upper arch to collapse, more or less. There's less room for teeth. You need more dental work. But that also means, and here's the thing, it means that there's less space for the nose and the nasal cavity to develop. And this is a problem that I'm dealing with myself, is that my nose is very narrow, and I am my nose is almost always clogged up. This is the reason why I know so much about nose breathing and all of this stuff, because I'm very bad at it. I'm continuously working to improve my nasal breathing to make sure that I breathe through my nose throughout the night. So every night before I go to sleep, and sometimes twice, I check whether my daughter is nose breathing. And I've never seen her mouth breathe at night, but I always check whether she's nose breathing. And even for me, if I have spent a night with a clogged nose and I've done more mouth breathing, I just know that I'm going to have not as good of a day after that, because it just messes with my sleep a lot.
What would you do if your daughter was mouth breathing, if she was already asleep and you're trying to get her to breathe through her nose?
Well, actually, once I saw her mouth breathe at night, and I just tapped her chin a little bit until she closed her mouth, and then she kept it closed. It's as simple as that. Nice. Yeah, and if children are chronic mouth breathers, then there's an option of you can use a little bit of tape, put on the mouth, and tape the mouth shut, which is usually not nice for children. But now there's a nice product called MyoTape, which is actually a bit of tape that you put above the lips, around the lips, around the mouth, and it keeps the lips nice and closed. And it seems like an intense intervention. The problem with mouth breathing is that you don't realize how big of a problem it is. If the kid is just asleep, you're happy the kid is asleep and it doesn't wake up, fine, you know. But years and years of night after night, so many hours of mouth breathing will lead to a destructured face, to very high likelihood of developing allergies, of developing dental problems. It's really such a simple way to keep yourself, to prevent a lot of these issues that mouth breathing can cause.
Do you perhaps have some examples of breathing techniques or exercises the listeners may be able to use with their own children?
So with children and breathing techniques, it's very important that it's playful, because children usually don't need techniques, and it's no fun to sit down and be like, breathe like this and now do that, and to follow all of these instructions. So think of little breathing games. So for example, my daughter has a dream catcher above her bed, and it's a beautiful dream catcher from Mexico, and it's like woven, and she loves looking at it, but there's also feathers hanging from it. And these feathers are kind of dangling above her bed. And what I love to do with her is to play a little game to see if we can make the feathers dance. And so we blow to them. So we take a really big breath in, and then we blow against them. And then the feathers start to dance, and they move around a little bit. And then I can see, can you maybe make them dance really wildly? So we blow really hard. You go like that, and do some really deep breaths, and see if the feathers can dance more wildly. And then, for example, I invite her to take her next breath in through her nose and see, like, oh, let's see if we can make the feathers dance for longer if we breathe in through her nose, and then we breathe out through our mouth. And then, you know, I teach her to breathe through pursed lips. Like, for example, you are breathing through an imaginary straw, and make this tiny aperture in your lips and go to be more targeted, to be able to make one feather dance and the other one's not. So what I'm doing there with her is I'm helping her find ways of breathing, and then she will experience in her body how that makes her feel. That's the most important thing, for a child to develop the awareness that your state of being, the way that you feel, is linked to the way that you breathe from moment to moment. And by blowing against these feathers, I am focusing on the exhale and training her to lengthen her exhale in this very controlled way through these pursed lips. And this is actually a great way to enhance function of the parasympathetic nervous system, which is exactly what she needs before sleep. So especially if a child is restless or has a hard time calming down before sleep, then sitting them down and being like, okay, be quiet and do this mindfulness practice, breathe for this long, that's not going to help. I mean, people who don't have children, by all means, try it once you have a child, but that's not really how it works. If they're already active, inviting them into a little game, that can work really well. So there's many different ways to play, and this is just the one that I use. But if you can find a little game that focuses on lengthening the exhale, targeting your exhale, breathing through pursed lips, inhaling through the nose, then you're actually getting a lot of the calming parasympathetic states and benefits of these states right before sleep. And you're basically teaching the child that they can influence their personal state of being through breathing in a fun way by doing it together.
Another one I've heard of is breathing, you breathe in through your nose. So you're telling them to smell the flowers and then breathing out through the mouth, you tell them to blow out the candles for like that long exhale.
Yeah.
Now, can you tell us about your book, Mind Lift?
Yeah, so Mind Lift started as an experiment. I was working as a science teacher in school, and I was learning a lot about brain development and about how the brain learns, and seeing a lot how the education system is not teaching anybody to use their brain the way it should. And I was like, wait, I'm a teacher. I'm basically a brain programmer. Why do not I know anything about, or why do most teachers not know anything about how the brain works, which is the kind of like the organ we're working with? So I started studying a lot of that, reading a lot of studies, and noticing that there were so many ways to influence our mental state of being and our focus, which is really something I was working on because I was a teacher. Then I had my own health. I was in bad shape. I was 35 kilos overweight. I was depressed. I had low energy, just not feeling good. And I was young. I was like 25, and I just was in a very bad state. So all of that combined led me to want to spread this message of, hey, we can actually do a lot to improve our ability to learn, our ability to focus, our ability to have energy. And in order to kind of challenge myself to test whether I really knew about these things, I decided to write this book in 30 days because I had always learned that I was bad at focusing and concentrating, and I was not good at books. Like I barely read any books before, and especially in school, it was like, yeah, Casper can't finish his books. So I was like, okay, you know what? I have these limiting beliefs about not being good with books and about not being good with focus. So I'm going to write a book about focus, and I'm going to do it in 30 days to test if I can really do it. And so I did. Worked really well. And that's almost 6 years ago now. And it's still out there.
Yeah. Wow. So does it cover some of these topics we've talked about today?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I get the feeling there's a lot more you can talk to us about than we'll have time for today. So in addition to cold exposure, barefootedness, nose breathing, what else is worth exploring more? I'm saying this because I'd love to have you back for another interview to talk more about this.
Well, there's a lot. We've barely even talked about breathing. Mm-hmm. And then there's, of course, the more philosophical, spiritual topics. And one thing that I'm very passionate about is death, so to say. Sounds very very intense. But to understand that death is a very important part of life, and this always comes back in my teachings. These practices of cold exposure, heat exposure, breath holds, fasting, a lot of these techniques that we use to improve our health, I like to call them microdoses of death, where we face the body with a death stimulus in order to get better at life. In my day-to-day mindset practice, I remind myself that I'm going to die. I remind myself every day that life is finite. It's going to end. Life is defined by impermanence. And we're losing it every single day. and we can try to grab on as much as we want to our health. And there's a lot we can do to optimize our health, which we, I think, should do. But in the end, we're going to lose our health, and we're going to lose our time. We're going to lose our relationships. Everything we build that is of meaning, we'll leave behind when we leave this life. And that is something that inspires me every single day. It's something that inspires me to be a better parent, to be a better teacher, to be more of service to my audience, to remind myself that, that death is real and it's very close. And I think, that's another very important practice that I use in my daily life. And also little moments of personal death, of ego death. I like to challenge myself, learn new things, develop myself in ways where older parts of me that no longer serve me have to kind of disappear and, or have to be let go, or in other words, have to die off. And in my personal experience, struggling with anxiety, with addiction, with depression, with all of these things, understanding that life is finite, and also understanding that parts of you are allowed to be laid to rest, that we are allowed to have many deaths and many rebirths as often as we like, is a very, very freeing and very inspiring thought.
Yeah, it is very inspiring just to hear you talk about that. Some of those things that you're saying, like many, many deaths and many, many rebirths. Yeah. So I will put links in the show notes to your MindLift website and Instagram page. Is there anywhere else you recommend if people would like to learn more or to get in contact with you?
Well, for my work on breathing, you can go to breathworkmasterclass.com. That's the one.
Mm-hmm. Cool. Yep. Casper, I really enjoyed talking to you today. I appreciate you taking the time to share this knowledge with us. Thank you.
All right. Thank you so much for your time.
So my final question for you to end on is, if the entire world's knowledge was lost and you could only leave one sentence for future generations, what would it be?
You're going to die.
If you enjoyed this episode, you can join the discussions on our Facebook and Instagram pages. To hear more, subscribe for free on the podcast app on your smartphone. We are available on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, and all of your favorite podcast platforms. If you would like to offer feedback or suggest a guest, email us at untaming.podcast@gmail.com.